John chapter 3 and verse 30. This is John the Baptist speaking. When he was questioned about Jesus' ministry. And verse 30, we read this. He must increase, but I must decrease. It's very simple. It's very short. But what a challenge it is. He must increase, but I must decrease. I've often been struck by the intensity of this verse, because John is not saying it's better for Jesus to be exalted now. He's not saying, oh yeah, it's a good thing for him to be exalted. But instead he says, he must increase. This isn't a option. This isn't a, oh, this would be good to happen. This is a necessity that Jesus must increase. And just as much a necessity that I must decrease. This is the heart cry of every Christian. We are not in John the Baptist's situation where his ministry ushered in Jesus' ministry, and then his ministry decreased, and that's what he is discussing here, and Jesus is increased, but rather Jesus in our hearts must be seen more and more, and we must be seen less and less. This is our great challenge, our task, to see those areas where we do not line up with God, to remove them, to see those areas where Christ is at work and to magnify him. That's our goal. That's our aim. He must increase, but we must decrease. How can we decrease? That's the question that then we ask ourselves. How do we decrease? Do we belittle ourselves and our efforts? Do we hide in a corner and do nothing? These are both options that people take. They put on the false humility of, oh, it's nothing, whenever they put any effort in. Or they hide away and do nothing for Christ. And so, yes, they are decreasing, but Jesus is not increasing. They are not fulfilling the heart of John's cry here. How do we decrease? Well, we see the disciples had a 3-year crash course in this. And Jesus, we could look at all through the Gospels and point out areas where Jesus continued to show them that he was more than just a man, that he was there teaching them more than just good sayings, and where they continually strove for the supremacy, the preeminence, and then Jesus had to basically cut them down a bit to size. No, you cannot join me in what I am doing. You must follow behind. And so we can use them as an illustration, use their lessons as our lessons. If we go to the book of Matthew, and we'll be in Matthew for the rest of the message here, Matthew chapter 19. We have this rich young ruler who came, and he said he's done everything, this young man, in Matthew chapter 19, verse 22. And when the young man heard the saying, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. And Jesus said unto his disciples, verily I say unto you, that a rich man shall hardly, or barely, enter into the kingdom of heaven. And again I say unto you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God. And when his disciples heard it, they were exceeding amazed, saying among themselves, who then can be saved? And Jesus beheld them and said, with men this is impossible, but with God all things are possible. And then just as we, the disciples, drew the wrong conclusion from the lesson, Peter then pipes up in verse 27, then answered Peter and said unto him, behold, we have forsaken all and have followed thee. What shall we have therefore? Here, Peter rightly acknowledged, understood, saw that they had given up much to follow Jesus. He noticed, we have left behind our ships, our livelihoods, our families. We have been following you for 3 years now, almost 3 years at this point. They'd been following Christ, and so they have rightly forsaken all. But notice Peter's, the ending of that statement, how his attitude is in the wrong place. He says, what shall we have therefore? You see, Peter was wondering, are we going to be the most important then? Are we going to have a position of authority and power? What reward will we receive? Are we going to get extra benefits when God brings in the kingdom for Israel? They were looking for the wrong reward. We do need to see when we need to give up things or relationships in order to follow Christ. But in the midst of that, we need to be following Christ, not giving up things. Our focus is to be on Him, promoting Him. In verse 28, Jesus starts to educate him. Then Jesus said, verily I say unto you, that ye have, which have followed me in the regeneration, when the Son of Man shall sit in the throne of his glory, ye also shall sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And everyone that hath forsaken houses, or brethren, or sisters, or fathers, or mother, or wife, or children, or lands for my name's sake, shall receive 100-fold, and shall inherit everlasting life. If Jesus stopped there, Peter would have thought the answer was, I'm getting everything. I'm getting everything. He would be thinking, I have won the lottery. I'm getting 100-fold for every ship that I left on this shore of Galilee. I'm getting 100-fold for every house that I have had to leave behind. No, Jesus continues in verse 30 and says, but many that are first shall be last, and the last shall be first. Here, Peter thinks he's going to be the first to cross the line, and therefore he is going to get the best, that he will have earned the best. And Jesus puts him back into his place and says, yeah, but some of those that are coming last are going to be ahead of you. Some are going to be ahead of you that are first shall be last and last shall be first. Here, Jesus is telling Peter and the disciples that he needed to be first place in their hearts, not their eternal reward. The eternal reward is there, and it is something that they would receive. Notice at the end of verse 29 that they would inherit everlasting life. They wouldn't just be receiving houses and lands, but they would be receiving eternal life, something of greater value. But even still, that doesn't make them like this. It makes them last. It makes them last. We must decrease. He must increase. If we jump over a chapter to Matthew chapter 20, just the other side of the page for me, Matthew chapter 20, and we'll begin reading in verse 20. This was a recurring theme. What are we going to receive? What position will we have? What kind of inheritance will we be able to have that we can be the best, the greatest, the strongest? Matthew 20:20. Then came to him the mother of Zebedee's children with her sons, worshiping him and desiring a certain thing of him. And he said unto her, what wilt thou, or what do you desire? And she saith unto him, grant that these my two sons may sit, the one on thy right hand and the other on the left, in thy kingdom. This is positions of power, authority, responsibility that this mother is asking for her two children, James and John. They're called the sons of Zebedee or the sons of thunder. And I wonder sometimes if maybe the thundering one was their mother, not their father. Because she's the one who's bold here to come and beg Jesus for everything. And we don't hear anything from their father. So maybe it was their mother who was the thundering one. We're not sure. Anyways, James and John here, the sons of thunder, they are having requested for them to sit in authority and power. This is something that would be good to be desired. To reign with Christ, what a privilege. Just think of that. All eternity, the responsibility and the ability to help Jesus fulfill his desires, his goals, his aims. To sit at his feet continually. This is definitely something to be desired. But we find Jesus answering, and his answer is not what they wanted. Verse 22, Jesus answered, "Ye know not what ye ask. Are ye able to drink of the cup that I shall drink of, and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" And they say unto him, "We are able." And he said unto them, "Ye shall drink indeed of my cup, and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it shall be given to them for whom it is prepared of my Father." Here we have Jesus saying that that authority, that position of respect and honor, of power, was not his to give, but was to be given by his Father. And not only that, but that the entrance into those positions was not one of joyous conquering, but was one of extreme suffering. This cup, this baptism that he is speaking here of, was not the water baptism which was already passed, nor is it the Last Supper that he would drink. No, it was his death. It was his death, the death that he would die on the behalf of others. This is the cup that was prepared for him. And the disciples, most of them died in pain and suffering, not of old age. Most of them did join in with Jesus in suffering in their death. But we find it wasn't just these two who were striving. But in verse 24, the rest of the 10 were angry with James and John because of this saying. They were all striving. Who's going to be the greatest? Who's going to be the best? John the Baptist, whom Jesus praises as the greatest prophet. The greatest prophet. I mean, just think about that. For anyone to be claimed the greatest prophet, you've got a lot of prophets in the list there to look at. Prophets who raised the dead, who healed sick, who, you know, caused it to rain or caused it not to rain, etc., etc. There's so many prophets of God, and yet John the Baptist was the greatest, and yet John the Baptist's heart was, he must increase, I must decrease. The disciples had not learned that. They had not learned that. They wanted to increase. They were happy if Jesus also increased, but they wanted to increase. They desired to have power, authority, dominion. Jesus understood this, and so in verse 25, he calls them out for this striving. And he says, "Ye know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them, but it shall not be so among you." I can hear their hearts falling. They're like, James and John, we're going to sit beside Jesus maybe. At the very least, we'll be close to him. You know, and the 10 are like, "Oh, what are you doing? We want to be first. We want first place." And Jesus says, This is not how it's going to be with you. You're not going to exercise authority over others. Instead, in verse 26, whosoever will be great among you, let him be your servant. Now, I purposely read servant there. It says minister, but don't be fooled. This is not minister like someone in parliament. This is minister like someone who washes someone else's feet, as Jesus would do only a little bit later in this book. It is someone who is willing to be humbled in their service. Someone who is ministering is not the one giving great orders. It's the one who is fulfilling orders. Verse 27, whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. Chief among you, let him be your servant. This is the opposite of what the world does today. And I know today people use that phrase, oh, public servant this and a public servant that. But all of them like dictating to everyone else. They are not public servants in their attitudes, in their hearts. They do not serve others first and then themselves last. No, they serve themselves and call themselves servants to look good. Jesus then gives himself as the great example in verse 28. He says, even as the Son of Man, pointing to himself, came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. Turning upside down the whole hierarchy structure. The chiefest among you is the one who serves the most. The chiefest among you is the one who is servant of all. And our head, our leader, our great captain, the one who is going to lead us from victory to victory and one day will sit at the right hand of the Father, he came to minister, not to be ministered unto. This is quite a different picture than we're used to. John the Baptist understood that. He understood that he was there to serve for Jesus to increase. He was saying, it is not enough for Jesus to get more and more followers. It's not enough for him to have higher and higher place in people's estimation or in their hearts. But I must disappear from view so that he can have even more of the spotlight. I need to get down so he can stand on my back so everyone can see him. Not me. That's John the Baptist's heart. That's ours. How do we decrease? We see ourselves as last place, not first place. We all picture ourselves in this life's race as winning. You know, maybe not today, but eventually we're going to accomplish goal or dreams, or we're going to have the money or the house or the, you fill in the blank with the thing you're looking for. And we think of ourselves as winners. Instead, we need to see ourselves in last place. If I never get that thing that I would desire, enjoy, or like, yet Jesus must come first. He must come first. Others must come before me. I'm in last place. He's in first place. We also need to see that we are here to serve others, not to serve ourselves. He must increase, I must decrease. That means we are building a platform for him to stand on. We are making our life to be fit to shine the light of Jesus out. We are cleaning the lens and letting the light shine through. We are not the light, but we are allowing him to shine through us. This is how we make him to increase and us to decrease. We make sure he is seen and not us. If we go now to Matthew chapter 17, it's always interesting to me that this comes before the passages we've just read in Matthew 19 and 20, when the disciples have in their mind that they could be something, that they could be equal to Jesus or as good as Him or sit on the throne next to Him, that they could stand in power and authority, when only a few chapters earlier, not much time earlier, they, at least Peter, James, and John, had seen Jesus transfigured. Matthew chapter 17. And so they had seen Jesus in glory and in power, and yet they still, in pride, wanted their own things, their own way. It's hard to understand sometimes until I look at my own life. And then I say, yep, I'm that fickle. I could learn something today and then tomorrow have forgotten it. Turn my back on a resolution, whatever. So we'll read now in Matthew chapter 17 and see this transfiguration, this vision, this appearing, this manifestation of Christ in His glory. And after 6 days, Jesus taketh Peter, James, and John, his brother, and bringeth them up into a high mountain apart, and was transfigured before them, and his face did shine as the sun, and his raiment was white as light. And behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elias talking with him. Then answered Peter and said unto Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. Notice Peter's Peter's attention. Lord, us. Lord, us. Not Lord, you, but Lord, us. It's hard. Anyways, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If thou wilt, let us make thee 3 tabernacles, one for thee, one for Moses, and one for Elias. Again, he is seeing Jesus in bright shining raiment with a face that is glowing, that's shining, as it says there in verse 2, transfigured, that is transformed, made to appear as he really was. It's probably a better way of looking at it. The veil of this mortal life was peeled back for a moment so they could see who he truly was. And yet they are seeing Moses and Elias and saying, those ones are equal to you, Jesus. Verse 5, while he yet spake, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice out of the cloud which said, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him. Notice, God does not here say, this is my beloved Son and Elias and Moses. He doesn't say, here's Moses and Elias and Jesus in order of their time here on earth. Nor does he say, here's Moses, the great one, and here's Elias, and here's something about him, and then here's this other one, Jesus. No, he calls Jesus his beloved Son. He draws all attention and focus unto Jesus, and he says he is well pleased in Jesus, and he wants them to listen to Jesus. There are so many lessons we could learn here, even before finishing this reading. How, when we see Christ for who he is, do we immediately suggest things that we should be doing? Or do we listen to him, to hear what he wants us to do? Are we busy doing things, or are we listening to Jesus? Are we trying to meet with the one who is well-pleasing to God, or are we trying to somehow placate an angry and vengeful being in the sky, as so many around us would describe God as? They would describe God that way, that vengeful, angry man up in the sky. Are we trying to placate him, or are we listening to his words? This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him. Notice God's words are not angry. He is rebuking the disciples, James, John, and Peter. He's rebuking them, but notice how pleasant his words are. He is not using harsh words saying, you guys are so naughty and bad and evil and wicked. He could. Sorry, that's me talking to my 4-year-old, 5-year-old, and 2-year-old. You're so naughty. No, he's not. He doesn't say to Peter, James, and John, you got it all wrong. You're wicked. Instead, he describes Jesus, and he uses pleasant language. Beloved son, well pleased. He is describing Jesus in all of his glory. And he is describing him as one in a relationship of love and tenderness. Now, the disciples took this as it was meant a rebuke. In verse 6, they fell on their faces and were sore afraid. Then Jesus came and touched them and said, "Arise and be not afraid." And when they lifted up their eyes, they saw no man save Jesus only. I think God was very gracious to them here. They had seen Jesus in his power and transfigured with shining garments and, yeah, amazing. Yet they were distracted from him, and so God took that away. We are not ready to see God as he is. We are not ready. If we saw heaven today open up before us, our cry would not be like Stephen, "And there, the Son of God reaching down to welcome me." But we would probably be going, "Oh, and there's pearl gates. Oh, and there's that street of gold they were talking about." Wonderful things, but Jesus is the focus. He should be our focus. And so we have some time, fellow Christians, to turn our hearts to be like John the Baptist. He must increase, I must decrease. To follow in the steps of the disciples, to learn to serve others and to serve God. To be content with last place rather than first place. And to be looking unto Jesus alone. This should be our focus, to learn to see him at all points. They saw no man save Jesus only. Jesus tells us that this was a vision. This wasn't some sort of incident where Jesus became God or anything like that. This is a vision that they were able to see what was real. And they were not to tell anyone until after Jesus' death and resurrection. We have here a little bit of a hint at how we are to decrease and for Jesus to increase. Make him the sole focus of your sight. Make your eyes fixed on him. I remember as a boy, I was sitting in a service and a pastor said, "There's one way to make the furrow straight. Fix your attention on that tree at the very far end of the field. Drive towards it." Now, I've never had to do that till 2 years ago, but, or 3 years ago now. I've never had to do that when I was, but I remembered him saying that. You want to make the furrow straight, you pick something out in the distance and you drive towards it and your furrow will be straight. You don't look behind you. You don't look from side to side. You don't pick something just in front of you. You look way out in the distance and you get a straight furrow. And he said, "That's how you do it." We need to have our attention fixed on Jesus. That's how he increases in our hearts. And that's how we don't miss the mark getting to him. And then we put ourselves last. The children's song, "Jesus and Others and You." What a wonderful way to spell joy. Jesus has first place, others before me, and then finally yourself last. That needs to be our attention, our desire, and then we will find Jesus increasing, us decreasing, and our love for him growing, our joy in him growing, and that's when we know that we are ready. We are ready for him. If Jesus came back today, would we need to scramble home and get a few things sorted? These priorities that we've had out of place. Would we need a bit of time in order to talk to those friends and neighbors that we've been meeting to, but we're afraid to show Christ to them? We are getting in the way of delivering the message of the gospel of Jesus. Maybe there's others we need to apologize to, in that we have put ourselves and our needs, wants, desires ahead of them and their eternal souls. When Christ comes, there is no time. He comes with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and then we're there. Boom. There's no time to get anything sorted out. So, while he's not here, let's quick get sorted out. Let's get ourselves ready. Let's get ourselves to that place that John the Baptist was. Him increasing, us decreasing.